Then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One word more for signal token, whistle up the marching tune. For your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon. With your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud walled cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warming light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the banshee's lonely croon, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's August the 27th, 2015. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Tell you what, let's do this one a little back to front this week and start out with the last part of that August the 6th call-in show, the one where we got only the one caller from Florida.
We do stand up and fight this thing, but you know why I gotta fight? I gotta fight my own kind first. They're the ones that are going to come and get me.
Oh, yeah.
Try and
That's
kill me,
part,
throw
man.
Me in prison.
Well,
yeah.
The Northwest War of Independence, when it comes, and it will come, is going to be just like the first war. It will be a civil war between white men due to the presence of non-whites on this continent. Just before I came here to do the show today, I was in a comrade's house, and we were watching a movie called Gods and Generals about the Civil War. And we're going to have to go through all that again. And when it comes, it's going to be largely our own white people who are the cannon fodder of the dictatorship trying to repress and destroy whatever white nationalist insurrection takes place. That's almost a given. It's the sort of thing that really makes you wonder sometimes whether or not we deserve to survive, whether a people that effing stupid deserves survival. The thing is, though, it's repairable. If we could just have a couple of generations in some place like the Pacific Northwest, free of all this cultural poison, with some kind of decent economy and reasonable amount of prosperity and advanced technology so we can keep ourselves healthy and keep one step ahead of all the people who are trying to destroy. So if we could just raise one or two more generations in health, mental and spiritual and physical, we could do it. We could repair the whole lot. We could take it all back. That's going to be possible up until the 11th hour and the 59th minute.
One of the things that endears me to the Northwest Front is the fact that you're going to pull away from the society, because I think that's got to happen. I don't think necessarily that everybody that comes and joins the Northwest Front should immediately begin fighting.
No.
You know, I think you've got to build your homeland. You've got to educate the next couple of generations so they understand, and they're free. They're free of this brainwashing, and they know who they are. And then you can start accumulating strength. I don't think I'd attack the system.
I tell that to people coming up here. Says, look, you know, you do understand that when you come here, you're not going to be handed a rifle and sworn into the NVA and told to go out and shoot somebody or blow things up. It took 168 years between the first English landing at Jamestown and the Declaration of Independence. And during that time, the colonists had to build their houses, plant their crops, build their churches and their public buildings and their roads, and set up their society, make their money, live their lives, have their children, raise their families. And all of this had to be done before any serious defiance of the King of England could even have been thought of. The American Revolution would have been really logistically and economically and socially impossible even as recently as 20, 25 years before it happened, because our ancestors still considered themselves to be Englishmen. This project we're embarked on can be done. It's not whether we can do it, it's will we do it.
What do you think of aristocracy? I don't think we have any. I think maybe the white race, when they're involved in their farming and raising their families mm-hmm. and preparing for the cold winter, they rally behind and give their hearts, so to speak, to a person of aristocracy, and the aristocracy kind of guides the whole schmear amongst themselves to keep us moving forward. I don't see that today. I think anybody that rises above the general public, they can either get bought out, compromised, get caught fooling around with a little boy, or if they get too uppity, you know, they disappear. Like, comes to mind is JFK Jr. They did him in, and he was preparing to make a run to grab some power. So I just wonder, in some of your books, there's characters seem to rise to that level of a leader that people rally behind, and they don't question it. They do what the leader says.
Most people are the 5%. Apparently, among Aryan men, 5% of the population, almost an exact figure, has what I call the alpha gene, the leadership gene, the gene that lets people go first, the gene that lets them command others. There's just something about these people. Not only are they good at whatever they do, exploration or science or military, whatever, but they are able to convey to the rest of the 95% that they are good at what they do. And it's like the other 95% can recognize leadership in these people. And once they're comfortable with that, once they say, okay, well, you know, Colonel so-and-so or President such-and-such, he's a leader. He knows what he's doing. We can trust ourselves and our welfare and our families with him. They go ahead and they fall in line. We don't have leaders of that kind anymore for a variety of reasons. For one thing, a lot of them aren't white, and that doesn't apply to white people. Another thing is that there is no real hardship or stress under which leaders have to prove themselves anymore. No one has to fight the elements. Maybe World War II is a bad example, but the wars that we fight, we now fight with machines or with expendable people. Like I was mentioning, I was watching this Civil War movie before I came to do the program, and the Civil War, the American Civil War, was about the last war of any kind in the Western world where a significant number of officers and generals actually got killed. Just leaders don't really have to display leadership anymore in our society. They don't have to personally display physical courage. They don't have to display intelligence or planning ability or inspiration or vision or drive or ambition. Well, ambition maybe, but the things that makes you a quote-unquote leader in this society wouldn't have got you anywhere in the frontier days or even in, you know, say the Roman Empire or something like that. We're talking about a totally different animal here. It seems like that alpha gene is almost gone among our people. I don't think it is. I think it's still out there, and I think we can revive it. But we have to find these guys, and we have to get them inspired. We have to get them to northwestfront.org, and we have to explain to them the idea and the Northwest concept. And I think once we get those guys, and I've said before, it'll only take about 1,000 of them, in my opinion. We're on our way. We got it done. But we have to somehow find these men that have this long-dormant alpha gene, and we have to bring them in.
I think your vision and your thrust for Northwest Front will lead to that, because obviously when you can make your way out here in this crazy world we live in, the ones that do migrate there should be the better of the race. And as we said before, if you can establish yourself for a couple of generations, you've got leaders in there.
This is a bad comparison, but the closest thing to what we're trying to do has been done once before with the State of Israel. And the Zionist Jews started going to Israel in the 1890s, founding their kibbutzes, and they didn't immediately try and overthrow the Sultan or anything like that. They just moved to Israel, they opened little shops, or like say, or founded a kibbutz, or got started in trade and started working their way into the community. And over a period of about a generation, it took almost until 1929 before the Arabs even noticed the fact, hey, where did all these damn Jews come from? That was when the first Arab anti-Jewish riots took place, because they had infiltrated Palestinian society for about 35 years, very carefully, very slowly. It was like the frog being slowly boiled in the pot of water that was being slowly heated. And eventually, of course, the Arabs twigged to the fact that there were Jews everywhere who were buying up all the land, and they were getting more and more arrogant as more and more of them came. And so, unlike white people, the Arabs actually reacted and started rioting and physically resisting, which is where all the trouble in Palestine started before the war. We are going to have to do something like that. I say it's a bad parallel because Israel is a monstrosity, but we have to create a whole new nation with a whole new national consciousness, a white racial consciousness.
I think you're right, an analogy for me, but not the sense of being violent and destructive. It was the werewolf concept after the Second World War, where you did what you had to do to survive and you cooperated, but underneath you had another agenda, and it was to bring down the occupying forces. That's almost the way maybe that some of the white people that, for whatever reason, can't make the move. Why are they still cooperating with the system? Quit building the system up and making it work. There's a word for that. I forget what.
Collaboration.
Passive resistance or something like that. Oh. I just wish more people would do it. I do it myself. I've been doing it for years. I don't give to any charities. I don't give to the churches. All these people that are bringing this country down, going to a Mexican restaurant? Never. Matter of fact, on the radio station here in Florida, I got on one time, the local radio station, they were touting Puerto Vallarta. And this travel agency was doing a big ad on how you can go to Puerto Vallarta and the prices and it's wonderful and the cruises and whatever. And I called up and I said, why would anybody go to Mexico? I said, I wouldn't spend 3 red cents in Mexico. Do you people have any idea what they're doing to this country? And you're going to go down there and spend your money down there? I said, not me. Well, they cut me off quick. That's, I think, what people should be doing. Snub and don't cooperate with the forces that are literally killing us.
Well, we got 10 more minutes. Is there anything you want to go ahead and talk about during that 10 minutes, Richard? Because I'll be honest, I'm almost at the point rather than...
No, somebody else calls, we'll talk to him.
Any urgent racial topic that you want to talk about?
I'm going to bring up something, and I don't know how you guys feel about this. About the black population, I don't like them. I don't like to be around them. I don't like the smell of them. I don't like them.
Nobody
likes them. They don't belong here. And I feel sorry for them being here. They're like an animal that's in an environment that doesn't suit them at all, and they're trying to get back to what they're comfortable with. I think what the politicians do to them is really cruel. They can't make it in a society. For God's sake, so what does it take? And they're just using them in a divisive way to foment trouble between the whites and the blacks. It's certainly not fair to us, but it's not fair to them either. They do not belong in this environment. And they have a journey. They have a spiritual journey just like we do. We're searching for our spiritual journey. We want to be white people and have a white culture and move forward to higher and higher consciousness about the world around us. And that's when this pollution and stuff will stop. The National Socialists in Germany, it's not too well known, but they were ecologists. They were into health and fitness. Today, we're going the other way. But the blacks, I don't necessarily hate them for what they are, but I don't want them in my world. I want them out of here. Let them go their own world and let them evolve.
That, I think, is probably the way most whites would put it if they were allowed to speak honestly, but it has been made clear to us by the dictatorship that rules us that that is the one thing that we cannot ask. The one thing that we cannot, must not even think of is a world where we are allowed to separate ourselves from these people. I mentioned some shows ago, there is a plan right now where basically the Federal Housing Authority is going to start buying up foreclosed homes, and the federal government is going to start penalizing financially cities. I think they've targeted 1,200 cities and towns right now. That much has come out. And basically, if they have restrictive zoning ordinances that prohibit, quote-unquote, multiple family dwellings in single-family dwelling areas, in other words, they are going to compel local authorities to build housing projects, apartments, and tenements in single-family areas, in other words, white neighborhoods. And they are working to, right now, as they call it, eliminate segregated housing, and the slogan is, a zip code shouldn't determine a child's future, and all this horse manure. Basically, in order to, number one, break up Republican voting districts and also break up white neighborhoods, they are going to start physically forcing niggers into what have been, until recently, fairly safe white neighborhoods. That is kind of like the last bastion of so-called white supremacy. We are not to be allowed to separate ourselves from them in any way. There will be no more going home at night from whatever filthy job you have in the city to a suburb where you can at least, at night and on the weekends, live in some degree of safety and some degree of sanity without the presence of these niggers and their booga 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 and the beaners and their salsa music. We will be integrated. This has always been, I think, one of the reasons why they go after the private automobile. They want everybody riding public transportation where we will be physically forced into actual hands-on contact with non-whites. And for some reason, they think this is going to make us love them. It won't, but...
No.
It's one of these things that gets me to wondering, at what point will we finally resist? Sometimes I have this depressing feeling that we've just made up our minds that there's nothing that can be done and we might as well get on with the business of dying. Bill White once wrote to me that he personally was convinced that it's impossible to even think of winning, but all you can do is save your own soul. I can't go with that. I have to have hope, and I do have hope. It's really weird. I don't know why I have hope. There is certainly no logical basis for it. I see no sign, really, that the white man is resisting. Everyone's been saying for all these years, oh, we got to wake people up. The white man must wake up. And if we can just somehow bring this one fact in front of people or something like, well, if we can prove that the Jews killed General Patton, then the white man will finally wake up. I actually think that a large number of our people are waking up right now. And they're waking up. I think they've come to accept that the world is what it is, and they've come to accept the things that we've been saying for many years, and they're still not doing a damn thing. They're just continuing to run and hide. Most young white people, even most squared away young white people, seem to spend most of their young lives in an attempt to avoid the system. I think there's an impression out there among this last white generation that the system, government, the criminal justice system, politics, all of this stuff, it's something to be avoided at all costs. And the secret to happiness and self-fulfillment and a good life is to just avoid the system as much as possible. It is understood and recognized that the system is evil, but there is this impression that just nothing can be done about it. All you can do is escape and evade and try and get a little something for yourself. That's the attitude we've got to change, and it all gets back to bringing people to northwestfront.org and letting them know that there is an alternative. There is a way. We know what we're going to do, and we have the solution if we can just get people to hear it.
Harold, I had a suggestion that might entice people to take a little more interest in these shows. Is tell your story, like how you became racially conscious. It's a slow journey for some of us.
I've had people do that. We've got about 3 minutes left, and I can tell you in 3 minutes. At the age of 14, I got thrown into an integrated high school. Chapel Hill High School in Chapel Hill, North Carolina was my racial university. And I meant what I said when I read that thing out on RFN a few weeks ago. On my last day there, I walked up the hill and I looked back, and I just decided I was going to devote my life to making sure that no other white kid ever had to go through what I had to go through in there. I knew that basically my life was ruined. I just wanted to make sure it didn't happen to anybody else. That's how I became racially aware. But my third week in Chapel Hill High School, I learned the distinctive smell of blood. Some nigger. Last minute, we've got a blasted caller. You're on Radio Free Northwest. Who am I speaking with, please?
Chuck Donner, San Francisco, California.
Oh, okay.
Hi. I just want to say that all white people in America and all over should support the Northwest Front, even if they can't come home for a while, or even some of them, maybe not at all, because it's a noble cause. They're doing it for the race. I just want to give my message to everybody to pay Harold an extra $30 for the Northwest Observer, even though that comes with dues payers, because Harold needs all the help he can get to set up an agency to help get people home. So that's just what I want to reiterate again.
Chuck, you managed to call about 2 minutes before we were going to sign off. As I explained before to the listeners, these shows from now on are going to have to be about like 90 minutes because once we get all the editing done, I'm trying to get it under an hour and 20 minutes so we can make a CD out of it.
Okay, all right.
It doesn't mean we don't welcome your call.
It doesn't mean we do not welcome your call. It doesn't mean I'm trying to get rid of you. It's just you happen to call like 2 minutes before cutoff.
Like, gee,
I understand. Am I going to be cut off?
No.
That's good. All right, I'll try not to do that. But
no,
anyway,
it's not like
it's
on some kind of automatic timer or anything.
All right, okay. Well, anyway, that's my message to everybody who's listening and everybody, all supporters. Keep up the good work.
Sure will.
All right, bye.
I guess they're all gone now. We got a guy who, I swear to God, spends most of his whole week on the internet looking for strange things for me to play on the show. He's pulling a lot of really great stuff off YouTube, but for obvious reasons, on YouTube, a lot of the most to-the-point material is anonymous, uploaded from multiple channels under pseudonyms, so forth and so on. I'm really encouraged to note that one place where our wee little movement is really making some progress is in the area of producing higher and higher quality music and electronic stuff, like videos, including our first primitive cartoons. Now, a lot of the music seems to be karaoke tracks, but we've got individuals and small groups out there who are doing wonders with them, and this is one of them.
Hammett's got a quick hand. He's moping in his room in the occupied land. He's got a roll of dynamite hanging out his mouth. he's coming for you. Yeah, he's coming for you.
All the other yids with the cut-up dicks, you better run, outrun my gun. All the other yids with the cut-up dicks, you better run, faster than my rocket. All the other yids with the cut-up dicks, you better run, outrun my gun. All the other yids with the cut-up dicks, you better run, faster than my rocket.
Shlomo works a long day, multicultural stays in the white man's hate, and he's bringing me a dark surprise. 'Cause Dindu's in my country and he's black as night. I raise my hand and Sieg Heil. Join the KKK and five different militias, stock up on poison gas and say race war now like your Zyklon bin. Yeah,
all the other yids with the cut up dicks, you better run, outrun my gun. All the other yids with the cut up dicks, you better run, faster than my oven. All the other yids with the cut up dicks, you better run, outrun my gun. All the other yids with the cut up dicks, you better run, faster than my oven.
Oi, oi, vey. Oi, 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 vey. Oi, 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 vey. Oi, 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 oi. Oi, vey, 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 vey.
The cut up dicks, you better run, outrun my gun. All the other yids with the cut up dicks, you better run, faster than my rocket. All the other yids with the cut up dicks, you better run, outrun my gun. All the other yids with the cut up dicks, you better run, faster than my oven. All the other yids with cut up dicks, you better run, outrun my gun. All the other yids with the cut up dicks, you better run, faster than my rocket. All the other yids with the cut up dicks, you better run, outrun my gun. All the other yids with the cut up dicks, you better run, faster than my oven.
Comrades, and welcome to my fifth edition of Arthur Kemp's March of the Titans. Now, this series of chapters discusses the shift in Western society from religious dominance to secular ideology and commerce. The Inquisition embodied the extremes of medieval dogma and church authority, and there's really two modes of the Inquisition in Europe. In Spain, you had Torquemada, who investigated the Toledo Gates allegations and focused on Jews and Moors. In the rest of Europe, the concern was mainly with intellectuals and Protestant groups. Now, unfortunately, during the Middle Ages, the brightest tended to become priests and religious, so because of this did not have children. However, there still would be a renaissance that would start in 14th century Italy, and it was financed by wealthy Lombard families. One of the ways that you can see this change in mindset was when Leonardo and Machiavelli ended up writing about Florentine history. I know this seems rather banal in today's world, but this showed an ability to consider events outside of a biblical perspective. Now, eventually, the Catholic Church realized it could not suppress the new attitudes and ends up adding the writing of church fathers to the new knowledge base. In the same year as the Great Schism, and that was 1378, a time of two popes, where there was actually a pope in France and a pope in Italy, you have John Wycliffe, and he was English, and he was influenced by John Huss of Bavaria. Now, like Martin Luther, Wycliffe was opposed to the sale of indulgences, and of course those were when you paid the church for sins. Now, the Reformation led to a great many conflicts because there were so many different kinds of Protestantism, and one-third of whites would die in the various wars and skirmishes during the Reformation. Starting in the 16th century, you have the Peasant War, and you also have the St. Bartholomew's Day Massacre, which was affecting the Huguenots. One of the worst examples was the 30 Years' War, and it began with the Evangelical Union clashing with the Catholic League. Now, the conflict would also involve Calvinists and eventually Lutherans from Scandinavia. The religious conflict ended in 1635, but sparked a political conflict that did not end until the Treaty of Westphalia in 1648. This war defined the boundaries of Switzerland and Netherlands, and France became a major continental power. Now, sadly, as a result of this war, 50% loss of the German population was experienced. And really, the war ends up being something of a draw. I would like to talk about exploration and Britain and the Americas. Even in 1271, you did have some travel. You had Marco Polo, who was traveling with his father. But in the 15th century, you really start to get this strong interest in trade with the Orient. Now, initially, the competition is pretty much between the Spanish and the Portuguese. And you have Bartholomew Diaz, and he travels around the Cape of Good Hope. And as a result, they realize they can get to India by going around Africa. So Vasco da Gama ends up landing in Calicut. And in the midst of all this, you have Columbus, who's trying to get to India for Spain. And he wants to avoid going around Africa, so accidentally he finds the Caribbean and South America. Now, in 1497, you have Cabotto. He explores America for England, even though he's an Italian. Early on, really, except for Francis Drake, most of the explorers, as I said, are Southern European. But in 1588, Spain loses its fleet, and this gives an opening to the British. Now, the British then become very imperialistic, and they end up going to China as one of the places they go. The Chinese see British colonialism and imperialism coming, and in the 1680s, they become very self-protective. They restrict trade to four cities, and later on to suburban Canton. They enact various laws to prevent the British from gaining a foothold, such as preventing the British from learning Chinese. And as a result of this, the British end up seizing Hong Kong. And also in 1900, you have the Boxer Rebellion. Also, the Japanese don't like all this British imperialism either, and they end up rising against Christianity in 1612. For about 100 years, or nearly 100 years, you have a travel ban, but in the 1850s, they rethink that, and they end up remaking Japan in a Western image. They still end up refusing boat people, even Vietnamese boat people, unless they believe them to be racially compatible. The Orientals, again, very protective of themselves, a very different attitude from many Westerners. Now, I'm going to talk about North America and particularly the area that would become the United States. In 1620, famously, you have the Pilgrims. They were initially headed to Virginia after living for a while in Holland. They end up going a bit off course and landing in Plymouth. The Pilgrims really aren't alone. In the mid-17th century, you have various groups of religious fanatics that are attracted to the Northeast. They are given charters that allow a lot of self-government. In 1651, you get the Navigation Act, which meant that import and export had to be in British-marked vessels only. Now, when the colonies violated this act, the Bay Colony Charter was revoked, and King James decides to unify the Northeast. Now, Connecticut and Rhode Island would not give up their charter. By 1775, you have 2 million colonists. You have 1.2 that are not British, and as a response to the Stamp Act, you end up getting the Sons of Liberty, and you also have the Townshend Act, where Boston refused custom duty laws. Now, as a result of all this turmoil, in 1774, you get the First Continental Congress. You also end up with some famous events, such as the Battle of Lexington and Concord, where the colonists had a home team advantage. After 1776, British realized that the colonists were very serious. At this point, the British occupied New York. Now, at this point, two things happened. The colonists realized that they had to use guerrilla tactics. But really, even more importantly, they end up getting supplies and secret loans from the French and the Spanish governments. The French Navy ends up destroying British merchant ships. Now, this is also where you get the stories of John Paul Jones, because he was also involved in the Navy at this time. The war ends on October 19th, 1781, with the Treaty of Paris. However, a few years later, there would be the War of 1812, which had a lot to do with trying to keep the Americans out of the Napoleonic Wars. In this report, I'm skipping over all of the information about South America, and the author goes into how South America was different because of different demographic realities in that area. One of the points the author is trying to make, of course, in writing this book is talking about the influence of demographics on political situations. Now, I know a lot of the history in this series of chapters ends up being rather basic, and so it ends up being somewhat of a refresher on things that you've probably heard of before in many cases. At any rate, that's what was in the chapters that I ended up reading this time. And so I hope you enjoyed this review, and I thank you for listening, and hail victory, comrades.
Here's another example of that evil karaoke I was talking about.
Goodbye, Hillary. Will you ever prove it all that you had your own emails or keep them for yourself? seems a little flimsy, that you couldn't create two accounts on your mobile phone. It sounds a little lame, and it seems to me you lived your life like a scandal in the wind, never knowing how to frame you when the blame sets in. I would have liked to see truth, but who am I to kid? The scandal comes out long before the election ever will.
And this is from one of our comrades in Britain, who, for obvious reasons, needs to remain anonymous, lest he find himself in Parkhurst Prison for 7 years, as he might if he were convicted of uttering so much as a single syllable of any of this.
Greetings and salutations, fellow plebs. Today, we shall be examining the brain of a rather curious specimen, the social justice warrior, sometimes referred to additionally or substitutively by the designation progressive. If you will afford me a brief digression, the label progressive was actually first introduced by a colleague of mine, Dr. Painful Irony, a brilliant, if somewhat frustrating man. Anyway, let us begin with the examination, shall we? I do hope you're all as excited as I. My attention is immediately drawn to this section of the brain here, that appears to feature some sort of cybernetic augmentation, not unlike the Borg from Star Trek, only less green. If my assumptions are correct, this would be an EGM, or Embedded Groupthink Microchip. It is believed that the implant allows for constant communication with the rest of the collective, ensuring that no individual ever stray from the narrative of the moment. Just to the left, one will note the growth of a gender node, so named because it dictates gender identification in the subject, along with a need to view the world through the lens of gender politics. If we take a closer look, we might be... Ah, yes. This specimen appears to have once identified as mayonnaise. I must confess, I wasn't aware that one's gender could be a condiment. Just goes to show how behind the times I am. Kids these days. Further to the left still, we find the entitlement synapse. The size of each adjoining gland will have been determined by the subject's yearly income and other markers of success. We can deduce from the enlarged victim gland and nanny state behavior enabler that the subject was either incapable of or unwilling to accept that money must be earned. Receiving undeserved funds would, ordinarily, produce an acute sense of guilt. Alas, in the brain of the progressive, the guilt gland is inversely proportional to the victim gland. Therefore, as the subject's sense of victimhood increases, so its feeling of guilt for behaving like a complete and utter tool decreases. At the left edge of the brain, we have what, unfortunately, appears to be the growth of a smarter-than-thou tumour. So rampant was the spread of arrogance that the subject's sense of humour cell was reduced to all but nothing. The po-faced bugger was probably completely unable to distinguish between humour and sincerity. Adjacent to these, we find perhaps the most debilitating anomaly of all, the self-awareness centre. Its yellow nucleus should enable the subject to examine itself objectively, to curb hypocritical and otherwise disagreeable behaviour. Because of its abnormally thick cell membrane and cell wall, however, it seems unlikely the subject would ever have been able to gain access to self-awareness. Indeed, I suspect that, while alive, the individual probably would have been capable of whining about imagined harassment before proceeding to harass anyone who dared to offer a contrasting point of view. Poor sod. The three jelly beans nestled in the upper left corner are in fact the work ethic molecule, personal responsibility node, and common sense particle. Given that all three are unusually small, it would be reasonable to assume that, when living, the subject would have been entirely useless. and blissfully unaware as to how truly useless they were. We move now to the moral relativity grey area, nestled inside which is the progressive's trademark double-think section. The latter enables the subject to hold totally contrary beliefs at the same time as and when the need arises. Fascinating, really. While one might ordinarily experience cognitive dissonance when confronted by two contradictory thoughts or pieces of information, the social justice warrior, by contrast, has evolved to accept both while dismissing the inherent contradiction. For example, and this is completely hypothetical, a female progressive could quite sincerely cry, "Women are being denied a voice," while speaking to a conference hall full of attendees at an event for women's issues whose organizers invited her and other women to speak, and see absolutely no flaw in her reasoning. She might even go on to state that we live in a patriarchal society that harms men. Baffling, really. Absolutely baffling. Situated just to the right of the grey area is the faux indignation sulcus. This is absolutely pivotal to the social justice warrior's way of life, for it ensures that no matter how trivial or inconsequential the issue, say, for example, the pattern of a scientist's shirt, the subject will be convinced that it is offended, and what's more, that everyone should care about that fact. Upon discovery of the faux indignation sulcus, my colleagues and I posited whether progressives may be innately disposed to ethical solipsism, whether there might in fact be an SJW gene of sorts. We refer to it as the "I feel, therefore you should be" gene. I see that below the sulcus sits the crown jewel, the dog's bollocks, if I may be so crass. This is the political correctness lobe, without which the subject would simply be incapable of functioning. We believe that it dictates which words may acceptably be used, and in turn, those that may not. It tricks the subject into believing that multiculturalism is not only a good thing, but that it is without flaw, that a country's own flag is a symbol of oppression, but that everyone else's flag is merely an innocuous expression of identity, and that discrimination against a person based on their race or gender is unacceptable, unless that person happens to be male and/or white. Now, this very unusual, shuriken-looking gland is in fact the soft spot, also known as the safe space. It appears to act as a place of refuge for the social justice warrior when inconvenient information is being presented to it. It is said to produce warm fuzzies. Now, while in most humans the heart is situated behind the sternum, among progressives it appears to reside in a corner of the brain. What's more troubling still is that the heart appears to be perpetually bleeding. Moving now to the right edge of the brain, we find what could only be described as an enormous plug. A stopper. A bung. What, one might ask, is such a thing doing in a person's brain? An excellent question, to be sure. As far as I can deduce, the stopper, tethered to the political correctness lobe as it is, must function as a thought filter of sorts, preventing incorrect thoughts from entering or leaving the brain. You see, while social media may offer one the option to simply block those who dare to offer a conflicting opinion, interactions in real life aren't quite so accommodating. As a consequence, this particular social justice warrior appears to have developed a mechanism for filtering out undesirable information. This, good people, is an example of regressive evolution at work. Extraordinary. Taking down the insanity by just a smidgen, one will note the presence of a Marxism shrine below the think stopper. For social justice warriors, it is cultural Marxism that fills the space left vacant by the absence of critical thinking. For those unfamiliar, it is my understanding that cultural Marxism is central to the decline of the humanities, culture, and civilization in general in the Western world. So, I wouldn't worry too much about it. We move now to the blame the West synapse. First, on the left here, we have the white guilt protuberance, If one has ever been curious as to why progressives insist that all white people should bear the alleged sins of their father's 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 mate, this is why. Because, remember, in the mind of a progressive, no other race has ever done anything untoward. Ever. At all. Just white people. Moreover, all white people are guilty by association, however tenuous. Below it resides the guiltful history hypothalamus. This appears to act identically to the aforementioned white guilt protuberance, differing only in that it focuses the subject's attention on the past. It is thanks to the hypothalamus that we have Howard Zinn's A People's History of the United States. The final segment of the anti-West triumvirate would be the uncivil bellum, so named because it compels the subject to stoke racial, gender, and class tensions in their own countries. Thanks to the goading of this superfluous lump of bile, we have feminism instead of humanism. All lives do not matter, only black lives do. And instead of the 99% working together to reduce the growing wealth disparity, people such as myself are told, "Fuck off, you posh wanker," just because I say grass and not grass. Oh, and if anyone was wondering, the Super Saiyan eyebrow here is actually a patriotism node. Judging by the atrophied nerve endings, however, I very much doubt it was ever actually used. So, with the entirety of the brain examined, I feel confident in stating that the cause of death was unquestionably excessive exposure to logic and human decency. I should imagine that the bigoted bastard's think stopper came loose, and before it had time to scream, "La la 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 la, I can't hear you," it would have been all over. Thank you for joining me today, and please do remember, never go full social justice warrior.
Okay, I'm told I need to start being more magisterial in these podcasts, but I'm not feeling particularly magisterial right now. I'm feeling Grandpa Simpson-ish, so I'm going to ramble on and on about nothing for a while. Several weeks ago, I played an old ballad on here called Wind and Rain, sung by a female folk artist called Gillian Welch. It's a somewhat Americanized version of one of the most ancient ballads from the British Isles that we have any historical record of, called The Cruel Sister. For some reason, in the past few decades, it's been a very popular number for all kind of folk groups, possibly because of its long history, possibly because it's got sex and murder and supernatural vengeance and all that kind of timeless appeal. You know, 12th century National Enquirer kind of thing. I've heard versions of this song in every musical form imaginable, from traditional minstrel harp to Americanized Appalachian versions and bluegrass, and those appear to be legitimate, by the way. Our ancestors brought the song over with them from Britain. According to the internet, there are at least 21 versions of the ballad that were written down in the past, never mind how many oral variations were handed down over the centuries and sung by troubadours and castle banquet halls and by wandering minstrels in taverns and fairs and hillbilly guitar pickers sitting out on the back porch up in a smoky someplace. Now, that episode last month is at least the fourth time I've played one version or another of that song on here, including the famous Pentangle version from the 60s. Lorena McKennitt doing a version called The Bonnie Swans, and the Jerry Garcia version from one of his unofficial recording sessions when he and the Grateful Dead laid their electric instruments aside and played the kind of music they really wanted to play. You know, a lot of people don't know that. Jerry Garcia was a mean bluegrass banjo picker. He always said when he wanted to make money, he played rock and roll, and when he wanted to make music, he played bluegrass. Now, the song itself is about two sisters, one of whom murders the other by drowning because they both have the hots for the same man. In some versions, a knight or a nobleman, and in others, the son of the local miller or some other blue-collar type. In the one fictional book treatment I've seen of this apparently endlessly fascinating story, the two sisters are Scottish noblewomen who are in London either as guests or political hostages of some kind, and they're both trying to attract the attention of King Henry VIII, which, in view of the way Henry treated his women, seems kind of counterintuitive, but hey, it's just a song, right? Anyway, the gist of the song is always the same. The jealous elder sister pushes the younger sister into a river or a pond, and she drowns. Her body washes up on the riverbank, or is pulled to the shore by the locals, and then along comes a minstrel, or a harper, or a fiddler, or anyway a musician of some kind, and seeing the body of the murdered girl lying there, he does what any decent man would do. He chops her up into pieces and makes a musical instrument out of her body parts. Well, of course. Makes perfect sense. The instrument is either a harp or a fiddle, depending on how old the particular version you're listening to is, and it has magical powers. The minstrel or fiddler takes this macabre instrument into the marriage feast or wedding reception or whatever kind of party is celebrating the marriage of the older sister and the man in question, and it begins to play all by itself and denounces the bride for murdering her younger sister, presumably in some kind of ghostly song. The really long versions of this have the bridegroom whipping out his sword and cutting the bride's head off, but in most versions I've heard, the song usually stops at the party-crashing denunciation phase. Okay, so what is all this Grandpa Simpson rambling in aid of? Now, as I mentioned, some weeks ago, I played a version of The Cruel Sister on here for the fourth or fifth time since the show began in 2010. And the next week, what should show up in my email but yet another version of the same ballad? This one sung in both English and Irish. Now, this is one of the better attempts, in my view, right up there with Lorena McKennitt's Bonnie Swans. It's so good that I just had to say to hell with it, let's have an encore. Now, this is the last time I will play any version of this song for at least a year, I promise. I apologize to those of you who find our Aryan past crushingly boring and don't want to hear about anything prior to the Third Reich or anything musical prior to Ian Stewart and Screwdriver, and I know you're out there. But hey, this past made you just as much as it did the rest of us. I'm not quite sure why this song has such a ghoulish attraction, but it does. Folk ballads get started somehow, and they always have some basis in fact, even if those facts are long forgotten. A long time ago, something really nasty happened. I'd love to know what it was, but other than the few haunting lines of this song that has echoed down through the centuries, no one ever will. This is Julie Fowlis.
Vaatad kiued on sa kaasak siest raad, on tõske sege. Uhtan tšebe hinne en tšeele kandru, tšeerhen jägen tõske skeed leegi. The world two sisters came walking down the street, o'er the wind and rain. Older one pushed the younger one and cried, o'er the dreadful wind and rain. Othuk shining on she boy can find it all in yours. On the shkis again. A door than she ele and she on your hooch. She had hen you can dishkis get vaguely. So she pushed her into the river to drown. All the wind and rain. Watched her as she fluttered down, crying, oh, the dreadful. A heart to stone. Shit here can dish his skirt with me. Listen to the force that he did a mock as meal. On the shkis again. Only tune that the fellow would play was all the dreadful when she had hanging and dish his skirt
Okay, guys, I get the thing about me needing to be more magisterial, and I know people want to envision me as some kind of great guru sitting up on his mountain thinking great thoughts like Bill Pierce, but nobody's come along and dumped $300,000 on my desk from an armored car robbery, so I don't have a mountain to think great thoughts on. And by the way, that was not a criticism. In point of fact, Pierce was the only one who did anything constructive with that money. We're almost out of time, so let me get some housekeeping stuff done, and next week I promise I'll give the magisterialness a shot. For those of you who came in late, there are some comrades out there who think I'm spending way too much time on this show on housekeeping and inside baseball stuff, and not enough time doing what President Warren Harding called bloviating, i.e. expounding my view on life in general and the American situation in particular. Meaning they want me to concentrate on the traditional standard fare of all right-wing and racist groups to this day. News commentary, i.e. telling everybody what I think about what's going on. As if anybody gives a rat's ass what I think, and as if what I think mattered a tinker's damn and could change anything, which it can't. Look, guys, I know you hate it when I go all commie on you, but let's face it, they've got a few valid points and some great aphorisms and famous quotations, one of which is inscribed on Karl Marx's tombstone in Highgate Cemetery in London, which I know because I've been there. Philosophers have explained the world. Our duty is to change it. That being said, I understand that I can probably make a lot better use of the speaking time I have on here, and I will try to do so. I'm also aware that the increasing level of hostile listenership on here since the night of the Charleston Vespers dictates more care on my part as to the content of the show. I've made that point myself several times. As those of you who are what may loosely be designated party members and who therefore receive the organizational letter are aware, I'm involved in several major projects right now, one especially, whose common denominator is the massive consumption of my time. But Radio Free Northwest is kind of the party's flagship, and there's no excuse for neglecting it. I repeat, I will try to do better and rev up my game on here. Summer slump is coming to an end, so people are going to wander back from the beach and the lake and the picnic grounds and Six Flags, and they're going to start listening again. I've already posted several Covington novel updates on the blogs, and I won't get into that until there is a little more time for things to clarify. Now, one thing I do want to remind all of you on. One of the first things necessary to participation in any white nationalist activity of any kind is a secure personal mailing address, by which I mean an address which is accessible to you alone, where the mail is received and collected by you alone, and which does not rely on anyone else to pick up, direct, or handle your mail. Nor does anyone else have any legal control or authority over the mailing address and what mail comes there and what doesn't. Nor does anyone else collect the mail and have an opportunity to snoop and spy and give you grief as to what mail you are receiving. This is a long-standing problem that predates the internet. I myself rented my first post office box when I was 16 years old. You probably couldn't do that legally today at the age of 16, but a lot of private mailboxes aren't so scrupulous, especially those services owned by Asians. The reason I bring this up is that we recently had a situation wherein a comrade who lives with someone else complained to me that he wasn't getting his organizational letters and Northwest Observer copies. I don't know what exactly the situation was. He didn't explain further, and I didn't ask because it's none of my business. But being familiar with such difficulties down through the years, I advised him to rent a post office box. He did so, and his NF mail is arriving okay now. Odd that we don't think of such things any more than we do, but the fact is that for all the gabble in the Constitution about freedom of speech and freedom of religion and freedom of conscience, one of the simplest and most basic of all freedoms seems to have been left out. Freedom of association. The freedom not to associate with blacks or Mexicans or faggots or whatever. The freedom to receive mail and publications and emails and look at whatever websites we want. I keep trying to tell people that when my novels were banned in July, it's not just my freedom to write those books which was being trampled on, but their freedom to read them, although I haven't been able to get much traction on that so far. The freedom simply to receive a letter or a publication in the mail, or an email on one's computer without it being intercepted and withheld and without being harassed and abused and punished for daring to communicate with people who think bad thoughts, is one of the most basic freedoms there is. No one has the right to deny you that. In order to secure that right, our ancestors fired flintlock muskets at Lexington and Concord and artillery shells at Fort Sumter. But we don't have the balls for that anymore, musket, cannon, or otherwise. So we have to rent post office boxes so that we can hide our mail from the prying eyes of those whom the dictatorship has placed over us in positions of petty power, including the power of political and social denunciation, which Americans so fear. Anyway, our time is up for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98194, or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sarsha Andaban. Freedom.